Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned that the following program may contain voices of deceased persons.
My name is Margaret Brady. I'm a local Port Adelaidean. I'm part Kaurna, part Ngarrindjeri and part Mirning. We live in a multicultural country. Language for us is Ngarrindjeri and Kaurna language. My dad is from the West Coast. My mum is from the South, a place we call Raukan. It's also known as Point Maclay. I think it's the history of Port Adelaide and the Aboriginal people. We've always lived in Port Adelaide. I've seen a lot of changes growing up. Just what the children have today. For me, it's home. We have a strong connection to the land and the people. For me, I guess that's just who I am. I am what I am. Yeah. My mum was a strong woman, come from a strong line of women. She was a person to reckon with. She fought hard for, we call it Coomerang, but it's Hindmarsh Island Bridge. I'm next in line. I'm now the oldest in my family and have a legacy to pass my knowledge on to my younger ones. She's the one to start the conversation off probably 50 years ago. She's left a legacy. It's called Latilari. It's a park in Port Adelaide. So now we have a 75-metre park named after my great-grandmother. She was born on the Port River. She got told to leave about 1870 from the park. I say to a lot of people that our history never changes, and it's trying to take not so much my children but my family's children back to where we were born, where we lived. We were lucky because we had the opportunity to go exploring the Port Adelaide area. We know it like the back of our hands today. And I think growing up there, we've learnt the significant places. Where the park is situated, we get that vision of looking back down the river. Back in the day, my mum would explain that there were more campfires than anything. The men would go down to Outer Harbour and lay fishing nets, and it was like a seasonal time. They'd come back and then they'd go back to lift the nets out. The park was just developed with Latilari's story. It has the feel of sitting around a campfire and telling stories. I think it was her daughter, Nana Laura, she walked 200 kilometres because they fought strongly for women to vote. Latilari seemed to have left landmarks and paved the way for the next generation. It started with Mum would tell us a story about our great-grandmother catching the train with her when she was about 13, and every time they come to this place, Ethelton train station, she'd shake her fist in the air and said it was her birthplace. When I grew up, like being a young kid around the area, we used to go to the wharf and we'd swim in the water, but it was also the home of CSR, the Colonial Sugar Refinery. And the year that burnt down, my mum told her stories. So a heritage block went on it straight away. But the birthplace where the great Nana was born, it's under one of the pylons of the bridge. So they decided to bring it out 35 metres and register that site as the birthplace. It has what we call a whirly or a waddly, which is a shelter. And that's just a makeshift of where she gave birth, where they lived, where they slept, basically. I believe my nana married a Ngarrindjeri man. She was Kaurna herself. My mum always wanted two sides of the river to complement each other. So on one side of the river where we have Latilari and her story, the totem for this area is the black swan. Across the river is a story about the emu people, Chilbrookie. One day him and his nephew Killawathi were playing around when the nephew had killed one of the emus. You don't eat your totems and you don't kill them. So the tribesmen speared him. Chilbrookie picked his nephew up and carried him along the river, along the coastline, and then we believe that Chilbrookie turned into the ibis bird. So we see him everywhere in Port Adelaide now. And different spots, there were natural springs. They're Chilbrookie's tears. I mean, I'd been to a couple of them. The sand dunes at West Lakes, where the other one was, has all been covered up and lost now. And I said to Mum, I put my finger in it and I tasted it. They're warm and they taste like tears. As family, we recognise that those things are there, the evidence is there. All the history that's down there, the middens, and we're hearing about new bones being found all the time now, so.
I'm John Cooper Smart. I'm a retired doctor and an urban social historian. I write about Port Adelaide. My particular interest is in the people and the history of the people that live in those areas. I started writing history books, well, I suppose it'd be about 12 years ago now, maybe more. I was a member of the South Australian Maritime Museum and we had to put a book together, the history of Port Adelaide, and I just found the place so fascinating. So much of its history had survived. A lot of stuff was still left in Port Adelaide. The history is so accessible. I'm obviously English, so my interest in history was spurned in Britain, but I've also written several books on the street names, which is a fascination of mine. It's a good way of looking at history is to look at people's streets, people's buildings, their houses, and tell the stories of some of the people that live there. The first Europeans who arrived here in 1802, there were a number of Americans, Europeans, that settled mainly on Kangaroo Island. We know that they went across to the Coorong area, so it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't have come across to the Port Adelaide or the Adelaide Plains. Sturt had led an expedition that came down the Murray River, and one of the first things that Light, who was the appointed as Surveyor General, so it was his job to look for where to put this new city that they were going to call Adelaide. One of his first jobs was to find a harbour. And that was the problem. He couldn't find a suitable harbour. He did look very closely at Port Lincoln. There was sort of Encounter Bay around it, near Victor Harbour. But none of these places are suitable. There's no running water. They did eventually find the only reasonable place for a harbour, and that was in the Port River. Light had sailed up and down looking for a suitable place for several weeks, up and down what he called Gulf St. Vincent, until eventually he found this little opening and he rowed in, and then it opened out into Port River. And that's why Port Adelaide ended up in Port River, which is the only area where you could moor a boat in safety, protected by Lefevre Peninsula from the western winds. Much of it, we know, was mangrove swamp, which was extensive and tidal. So much of the day it would have been underwater. Port Adelaide itself has a string of a sort of a ridge of sand, which roughly corresponds to round about where St. Vincent Street runs. There were soaks you could dig into the sand, and water, salt water from the sea or from Port River, would drift through and be purified by the sand so it was drinkable. There was a lot of wildlife. There was certainly mollusks, you know, like any other mangrove swamp, a rich area for wildlife and bird life. Pretty much impenetrable to the average European, which is why when Colonel Light finally arrived in 1836 and tried to find somewhere for a harbour, it was pretty obvious that the Port River was the only sheltered waterway, but it was very difficult to find anywhere within the mangrove swamp where you could actually, you could then get easily onto the land. And the best spot that he could find was well up the river, almost up to Tennyson, where West Lakes is now. The problem was that no one knew anything at all about South Australia. One or two people had been here, people like Hart and Sturt and so on, but none of them had really explored the area. The stories that they had were these sort of rolling open pasture lands where you could plant crops and raise stock and so on. No, it wasn't like that at all when they got here. It was just where they landed was impenetrable mangrove swamp that was flooded twice a day. There were no big trees for building houses, obviously no brick factories or anything like that. So people arrived after a several-month sea journey. It must have been an absolute disaster for so many of them, in spite of all the good intentions. Wakefield put together this concept of an idealistic new colony where the poor and downtrodden but worthy workers could be shipped out to this place, which it was going to be run very much on capitalist lines, so that you would buy land in South Australia, and that would then fund the development of the colony, and that as these honest workers bettered themselves, they would in turn employ less well-off people, and you would very quickly end up with this sort of idealistic society where, you know, people could prosper. One of the problems with Adelaide was that it had no large, or very few large trees that were sort of immediately accessible where they wanted to build a city that you could chop down to build houses. However, Tasmania had a lot of beautiful trees that were ideal for building houses. So if you could hire a ship or buy a ship, sail to Tasmania, bring back the timber, you could sell it for an incredible profit in South Australia, which is what Hart did. The other way of making money, and just as much money, was by bringing stock in, because those original settlers, although they brought themselves out and their few possessions, they had hardly any animals, horses, cows, sheep or goats or anything at all. So if you could import those from places like Sydney or Tasmania, which had been settled previously, then again you could make a lot of money. Now Hart was particularly lucky in that he arrived in Adelaide, in Port Adelaide, just after there had been a massive fire which had wiped out much of the town. there's a desperate need for timber, and he happened to have a ship full of it. But his biggest venture, his most successful, was flour production. And again, it was, I guess, to some extent, a lucky chance, but he certainly had the insight to grab it. The cheapest and most efficient way to transport food was as flour. So he built an enormous mill in Port Adelaide, gathered the wheat that was brought in, turned it into flour, put it in bags, shipped it to Victoria, and made yet another fortune. Port Adelaide was always a contentious port. He discovered early on that he could employ Aboriginals to do things that Europeans would not do, one of which was working on cutting the blubber out of whales after you'd hauled them ashore. It was also very difficult to get the average European to work in a flour mill in those days. But he brought a number of Aboriginal people to work in the mills and allowed them to pitch tents and humpies and so on down on the water's edge.
Times back then would have been sad for a lot of them. My grandmother was a domestic slave for Captain Hart. Hart's cottage, it's old looking in its design. I've been in it to see a lot of photos that are still hanging in there. It's got a big Moreton Bay fig tree at the back, and it's been there for years. I think different times when I go there, I have this vision of a lot of Aboriginal children just dangling from this tree. I was just amazed by their crockery. It's just those really little high tea cups and saucers, and I imagine cucumber sandwiches with the crusts off. And before the bridges went up in Port Adelaide, they had the floating pontoon and it turned sideways for the boats to come in. So Captain Hart's wife was having a high tea, and all the people were on the pontoon when it turned sideways, so she was carrying on that the tea was going cold and she wasn't happy on that day. That's only one story.
Gold was discovered in Victoria, and people were struggling in Adelaide, so not surprisingly, an enormous number of men packed up and ran off to Victoria to try and make some money on the goldfields. And some did. Some came back exceedingly wealthy. But not only did that take many of the workers away, and a lot of projects in Adelaide just stopped immediately because there were just no men left to do the work. They also took a lot of money with them. I mean, they basically took all their household savings and to go and try and make a living from gold. The other thing about the goldfields was that they're very labour intensive. You needed a lot of labour. And one place that had a lot of men who were very keen to come and work was China. You know, the first thing you did was send a ship to China to bring people to Victoria to work in the goldfield. Victoria had a policy of blocking that. South Australia did not have such a law at that time, so there was several ships arrived in Port Adelaide bringing Chinese labourers. Once copper was found, once wheat was being exported, once sheep wool and mutton were being exported, Port Adelaide became a very, very busy and very successful harbour. But it was always a long way away from Adelaide, and that was a constant source of concern right from the beginning, that for a city to work well, it's good if it's built next to its harbour, like Melbourne is, or Sydney. And obviously that did not happen in Adelaide. So right from the start, there was this geographical division. To anybody who arrives in Adelaide, it's fascinating to discover this almost antagonism between the city and the harbour area, which has been represented ever since in terms of football teams, education, politically. It's certainly a real thing.
We always used to say there were three kinds of work on the waterfront. The three Ds: dirty, dusty and dangerous. And that fitted the bill pretty well. About the middle of the 1950s, I would say, about 56, 57, I was very restless. Couldn't find anything that really suited me, but I worked with a concrete gang down at the building of the B Power Station at Osborne. And it was while I was there that a neighbour approached me. He was a wharfie, and asked me if I'd like to be nominated for the next intake on the waterfront. And I was doing quite a bit of rigging down with the concrete gang down at the powerhouse. Thought it would be a really good job and something different. So yes, I said yes, and he nominated me. Another neighbour seconded me. And we were required to appear. About 100 blokes were required to appear at the Wharfies Hall, walk up onto the stage one at a time. It was well known at that time as the Parade of the Stallions. And we had the parade before all of the old members. If there was the slightest indication that you at any time had scabbed, that you had behaved in an anti-working class manner, if you had not been a member of the union in the area in which you worked, well, then you were immediately scrubbed off and told no, you were not acceptable, and you were sent on your way. So the old fellas had remembered the struggles of 1927 and 28, and they were going to keep their union strong and militant, and so that was very important. And so we tried to keep a very strong hold on the number of men on the waterfront. Ship owners wanted to flood it, and as long as they had plenty of labour there, they didn't care whether you got a living or not. All work on the waterfront then was, in Port Adelaide, was very physical. You could carry bags of wheat, 200-pound bags of wheat, 98-kilogram bags of wheat, for 3 weeks. Now you can imagine that after 3 weeks of carrying cargo like that, you had to be extremely fit. We were extremely fit. And that probably was the salvation of some of the illnesses a lot of blokes did get, because with that, some of those ships were absolutely infested with rats. We used to have a rat-catching episode when we got to the right down to the bottom of the lower hold, and we would throw out of the way all of the old dunnage and the rubbish that was there and grab a lump of wood and go hunting rats, and the ships used to be full of them. They would be living in the bilges. Some of those ships were terribly rat-infested. The ship owners and his representatives, his agents, and very often his senior employers, like his supervisors. Most of the supervisors were ex-captains. Now, ex-captains were not known for their goodness of heart. They were hard men, and so the only thing they were interested in was moving cargo. We worked in gangs. We worked through 16 men in a gang. And every gang had a delegate. That is, we selected someone amongst our number who we considered a militant person, somebody who was prepared to fight for our conditions. It was his responsibility to take care of the welfare of the men on the job. And if any approach had to be made to the employer, you went to the ship's delegate, told him what the problem was. He then approached the employer. Only one person approached the employer, and he argued the case with the employer. If it couldn't be resolved in that way, and then the union official was called.
Port Adelaide has had a mixed history in the last few years, but it looks as if it's about to come good again. One person who has a great deal of faith in the port is Stuart Gifford, author, illustrator and restaurateur. He's just written a book entitled simply The Port. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Jonathan.
The port is subtitled Heritage, Development and Prosperity. Do you see prosperity returning soon to Port Adelaide?
Yes, I think it's very much on its way now. And what it is, it's a prosperity for the community rather than individuals. So if you look down there at the moment, you could raise some questions about that. But if you look collectively, you'll see that there's a general advancement of the whole community. The port's got some huge assets, a lot of which haven't come across yet. Not the least amongst them is the part of there's all sorts of parts of the community, one being the Kaurna people. And that's a very, very important one, that when the Europeans originally arrived, the Kaurna people were there. The Kaurna people are still there, and they're still part of the community, and they'll be part of the future. They were occupying the Adelaide Plains for a few thousand years before we arrived.
Yes.
And we haven't done, you know, an awful lot to improve it in 160 years.
No, far from it. The opposite, I would have said.
But in the port, it's got some of the better things occur down there. We do have a bit of pollution, a few obvious things like that. But we also have the sense of community, probably the strongest in South Australia. And I think that's the thing which is going to carry us into the future with great stead.
Yeah. The character of the port, it's obviously changed. I mean, it was a very, very busy port. There would have been sailing boats lined up at the wharves and quays. There would have been enormous warehouses, the wool warehouses and everything else there. And it would have been it was a very bustling commercial centre, probably much busier than the city of Adelaide.
It was.
In the 1870s and 1880s.
Mm. The railway that was there was being planned less than 10 years after Stevenson's Rocket ran. So it was a very early railway. It was the first government-owned railway in the British Empire. So, in fact, it contributed to the port's success.
Mm-hmm.
The port, in fact, as you were suggesting, the port almost became the main retail centre rather than Adelaide. So it was an urban centre. It was generated from London, and London at that stage, of course, was the centre of mercantile activity in the world. and the busiest port. Population had just reached 1 million, so it was an offspring of London in a lot of ways, and it looks like it.
Mm. Yes, in that early Victorian period, it was almost a sine qua non that a port was important, and it was probably more important than anything else in the area, so therefore it would have been considered as more important than the city, almost, to people from London. You're talking about the buildings in the book at the moment.
Yes,
the port.
Exactly, yes.
There's that missing element of the people, isn't there?
You're absolutely right. What we should see the buildings doing is illustrating the history, and so we see the buildings, which are very easy to look at. The next thing is to say, okay, why are the buildings there? Why does it look like it was so busy? Mm-hmm. And I just mentioned that you mentioned it was busy in the 1880s, and it was, but that continued up until the late 50s.
As long as that?
Yes.
And it was still a very busy port then?
It was a busy port, but diminishing. It was the second busiest retail area by a long way, mm-hmm. and in fact the problem that caused the end of the port in some ways was suburbanism. The fact that the port has rejected suburbanism is probably going to be its another strength in the future, is that when suburbanism wears off, the novelty wears off, as it's doing, then we're going to get back to urbanism, and the port is sitting there waiting for that return.
I was going to ask you how you saw the future of the port as a dormitory for Adelaide or as a separate community, but it must be quite obvious you see it as a separate community.
I think, being a little bit daring, a little bit provocative, I think you'll see it as the other way around. I think you'll see the port as being the centre of urban activity. People look at the transport systems. The best transport system is the railway between the port and Adelaide, and people view it as people going from the port to Adelaide. I think you'll be seeing it the other way around. I think it's the access from Adelaide to the port.
I see. That is provocative, I think.
October, 8th of October 1942, I commenced work in the shipping department of, as it was then, Vacuum Oil Company. I was 16 and a half when I commenced work, located in Divot Street, Port Adelaide.
And that was something special there, wasn't it?
Well, yes, I mean, at that time, personnel joined the various forces. Well, they were left then with vacancy and their staff, so female personnel were then engaged for that situation. I was the one that was chosen.
First one.
It was all a male office. Mm.
So and that was. Can you remember your first day at work?
Yes, it was a Thursday, the 8th of October, 1942. I remember it very well. And I'll just say it was a wonderful boss, Harold Shannon. He was one of those kindly personalities, and that was my introduction into an office.
Right.
And being shipping department, you naturally met the senior officers of the tankers, also realising that things at that stage had to be secret, what have you. I mean, there was departure dates and vessels' names, and all that was confidential, and this is where you had to sort of, listen but don't talk. Yeah. And that's when, you know, as I say, that you realise the seriousness of what was happening.
Yes.
Well, Captain Hans was one that, having not this 2 weeks, he actually was staying at the Largs Pier, but during, he'd come into the office every day. That's apparently what they had to do, to report duty, and like after 2 weeks, the tanker came and he departed. The other master came off and he went on, and that's when we realised, when we're doing our codes up some time later, that this was one of the names that was deleted. And it wasn't like to after the war, and it was quite a few years after that he came back to Adelaide. And that's when I realised then, I mean, he left quite a young-looking man.
Right, yes.
But when he came back, for us, when you think back, we knew these things went on, I suppose, but hearing it from someone, that he was actually a prisoner in Japan. He and the chief engineer had been taken prisoner of war. All their crew, unfortunately, were not. And that's when he told us what really had happened. So that's when you realise the atrocities that were happening. I mean, as I say now, years later, we know all about it, but at that time, it really sort of hits you, you know, you thought, gee.
My nana, she had, she rallied to get programs and stuff for us kids. Like, when we were little, we attended this old church in Dale Street, Port Adelaide. We called it the Sunday Club. Also, it was a respite for Mum. She must have hung out for those days. And we have an elders, we have an elderly group there. They're called the Granny Group. They've been going for 20 plus years. I'm now part of it because my mum was part of it. But the Granny Group now is about strengthening families. Part of this has been going on all my life. At the very beginning of my life, we were fighting for land rights. Then it became equality. Now we're fighting for justice. Some people take us for a less than. The Latalari story is that at the time Mum had told it was probably four or five generations, so we call it a matrilineal story because it's only between women. And since she's been gone, we're now eight generation, nine generation coming. So, I mean, if I say that Mum's a strong woman and I believe myself is to an extreme, then they do have that strength to want to carry it on. I'd have to say it's Latalari. It's like a serenity. It's, yeah, I think we get to feel and do whatever we want there, in a sense. I mean, we know that we still got to go home to our houses, and but I've had a lot of kids from different schools down there say, where do I live? And I asked him one day, what makes me any different? I live in a house just like you. We don't live any differently in the city. Our kids don't live any differently.
Nakana panuko kalta marla koi richanendi inki dinki do tam day.
Overboard, an audio history of Port Adelaide, was produced on Kaurna country. Its sovereignty has never been ceded. This podcast was produced by Nicola van der Wettering with generous support from the City of Port Adelaide Enfield's Creative Industry Grant. It was mixed by Isaac Whiteman and Nicola van der Wettering. Many thanks to interviewees Margaret Brodie and John Cooper Smart. Acknowledgements to the City of Port Adelaide Enfield's Library, Local History Offices, Linda and Cindy Crook. Archival sound includes interviews from Rex Munn, 2008, Jeannie Bloomfield, 1995, courtesy of Port Adelaide Library Archives, and Stuart Gifford, 1998, courtesy of ABC Adelaide Archives. Special thanks to Chester Schultz and Eliza Knowles.